Chariot Solutions TechCast number 33. Red Hat JBoss's Pete Muir on WebBeans and JSR 299. JSR 299, the API formerly known as WebBeans, is a Java-based configuration and dependency injection system for the Java EE platform. In fact, the JSR has been renamed as such with the short name JCDI, and the original title WebBeans went to the reference implementation, which is being led by my guest, Pete Muir of Red Hat JBoss. Pete and I discuss the JSR, what features it brings to Java EE, where to find information about the specification, and the WebBeans reference implementation. We spoke last week. So where are we talking to you from? Are you out near London or?
Yeah, I live in the UK. I actually live up in Scotland, in Edinburgh. So a long way north, up in what most people in the UK regards as the frozen wastelands. But it's actually sunny today, so that's quite nice.
That's good. We have your rain.
Yes.
We've had it for weeks. So, all right. Well, so let's talk a little bit about WebBeans. So I understand, you know, the original name for JSR 299, the working draft name was WebBeans, and now it's been renamed as Java Context and Dependency Injection. So I guess WebBeans is now your reference implementation?
Exactly, yeah. It has in general got a little bit confusing. I've struggled to keep up at times with the name changes. As you say, I mean, the JSR number is 299, and originally it was called WebBeans, and there was some concern, I think it was after the first public review draft, that the name really didn't reflect what it was trying to achieve anymore, because it had really morphed a bit from this way to just write sort of WebBeans, and morphed a bit more into a sort of more general spec. So the name got changed, and this was very much a group decision to Java Context and Dependency Injection. And subsequently, again, I think it's changed to Contexts and Dependency Injection for Java Enterprise Edition, which is a bit of a mouthful. So typically, we tend to refer to the spec as JSR 299. And as you say, originally, obviously, we had the WebBeans reference implementation, the WebBeans RI. After the names changed, we just renamed the project to WebBeans alone. So, yeah, the WebBeans is the name for the project that is the reference implementation.
Gotcha. So let me ask you a question around that. So right now, SIEM is what, 2.0 something, and you're working on the 3 or 2.1, I should say, and you're working on the 3.0 release of SIEM, right?
Absolutely. So we're currently working towards the release of 2.1.2 of SIEM. That will be out about, I don't know, this you know, within a month of when we go out easily. We're going to do a 2.2 release subsequently. That will just be a pretty minor release and probably involve just upgrading some of the other things we integrate with. So we also integrate with projects like JBoss Drools and JBoss Business Process Management, JBPM. And so this 2.2 release is really just to move to slightly newer versions of those. And then the main focus at the moment, as you say, is on SIEM 3, which is really sort of the big push for the moment.
So for people who haven't learned much about SIEM, we did a two-part podcast with your cohort, Dan Allen, discussing it in detail. But I'm looking at SIEM and I'm looking at WebBeans, and my original understanding of SIEM was that there was this bijection injection framework. Is that what is going to be replaced by WebBeans mostly in the future with SIEM?
Absolutely. So originally, you know, sort of digging way back into history, SIEM evolved as this framework to tie EJB to JSF. And a large part of that was a sort of contextual dependency injection framework that allowed you to do, you know, typical sort of dependency injection, but in a contextual fashion, taking, you know, advantage of the fact that we were in a serverless environment and had requests and things like that. Over time, SIEM has really sort of morphed a bit, and it's really become what I normally describe as sort of three or four things. So the first thing was the core, which is this contextual dependency injection engine. The next thing is it's sort of an application stack and of integrated other projects. So like I said, we integrate with JPPM or Drools, and we also have security and reporting to PDF or Excel and you know, Java Mail integration, things like that. So it's, you know, it's a stack of technologies that we would recommend you use when you're building your application. The third thing it is sort of tying very neatly into the second is that we provide an integrated development environment, tooling for all of these things in one package, so that, you know, you've got the whole, you've got your stack and you've got your tooling for your stack. And the fourth thing, really, which is where my work on the JSF2 expert group ties in, is that there were a lot of, you know, the primary target originally was JSF, and there were lots of shortcomings in JSF that we wanted to address, and so we addressed lots of those in SEAM, and subsequently they've all been rolled back into JSF2. So coming back to your question, which is how does WebBeans fit into this picture? Probably having explained it, it's quite obvious now, right? I mean, WebBeans is this, you know, this Java context and dependency injection, so that takes over the role of the core, leaving SEAM the sort of, you know, the application stack and the tooling. So SEAM is then much more the sort of the bigger package you can use to build your applications.
Mm-hmm. And then people going through Java EE development in the future benefit from the development work you guys did on SEAM to get the dependency injection working that you then helped contribute back to the expert groups.
Exactly. And SEAM will continue to provide all these things that aren't specified in Java Enterprise Edition, like, you know, security or reporting or integration with JVPM. That will all continue to be something that we offer outside of the 299 specification implementation.
Right, right. All right, so if we had to ask, you know, and SEAM being, you know, originally suited to components in EJB, glued into JSF so that, you know, a JSF facelet could just directly reference a component by name. Now, I know that you can basically create regular old bean components, but if you're doing web beans coding, right, you want to create a web bean and inject it, or you want to expose a bean for injection, what does that look like?
It's pretty simple. If you're used to SEAM, then you'll be used to putting some annotation on the class to indicate that this class should become a component. With web beans, in fact, basically every class in your archive that you deploy becomes a bean. It can be injected into other beans. And, you know, there are a number of rules, right? You know, if it's a, you know, pretty much any class, simple class, standard Java class would be one. You know, it has to either have a no argument constructor or a constructor that's marked as being the one to call by WebBeans, and then injection would be used for the parameters. You can't mark the class final or something like that. But, you know, most beans that you write as an average developer would automatically become WebBeans. If it's an EJB, already, then it will get picked up again as a bean. But rather than web beans controlling the life cycle of the bean, the life cycle of the bean, the instance of the bean is still held by the EJB container, and web beans just provides a set of services to that bean, like the richer dependency injection, the event bus, and things like that. So really, you know, in its simplest form, to write a bean, you write a class. If you want to start taking advantage of the injection facilities, which I guess is the obvious first thing you'll be looking at doing, you wire these together using annotations. You can inject into constructors, as I said. You can inject into fields. You can inject into initializer methods. So there's a special type of method, a bit like a post-construct method, which is called to initialize the bean. And that can take parameters into its, you know, you can If you create a method with parameters, then the parameters will be injected for you. And you'd use an annotation. I suppose this is starting to dig a little deeper into some of the technical details, but one of the things that sort of possibly differentiates some dependency injection frameworks is that, you know, you have to differentiate between what to inject into a particular field. You can't just, you know, there needs to be a way of specifying what you want to inject. If you're using something like SEAM, this is string based. So, you know, there's a string that uniquely identifies this thing you're going to inject, and it pulls it in from the relevant context and it injects it into the field. What really sets 299 apart here, and this is quite like Juice in form, is that it is type safe. So in other words, gone are these strings to differentiate between what to inject, and in come the use of types to do this. Now, of course, you can start to differentiate between things based on the type alone, but you might well have multiple implementations of the same type that you want to inject, and you need to differentiate which implementation you want to inject into a particular field or parameter. So what 299 does is use annotations to further restrict what can be injected. So, you know, you can put a You put an annotation on your bean to say that this has a binding. This is what we call binding types. These restrictive annotations are called binding types. And you put a binding on your bean, and you put a binding on your injection point. And if they match, then it will be injected.
Not to interrupt you, but you have a really nice presentation linked to on your blog, which we'll post a link to at the end. But it's called Introduction to Web Beans 1, I believe is the actual document, or Introduction to Web Beans, I should say.
Yes.
And, you know, you have pretty clear examples there that essentially, as long as you either take the default injection, which is I think called current, or if you put current in front of a variable when you define it, and if you put public or current in front of the class definition, then it can find it and inject it automatically. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yep.
So really, as long as you create objects and make references to objects, it's going to wire it automatically by default.
There are lots of different special options you can use in 299. You can do all sorts of advanced things, but in its simplest form, writing a simple application, you've got a few annotations to denote injection points. But that's pretty much what you're putting on. It's just an annotation for an injection point. So pretty simple. And if you're writing a simple app where you've got one implementation of a particular type, then you can just use the default built-in binding type, as you said, and it will wire that for you. So, if you've got one implementation, it's doing something simple, it pretty much just works as is.
So there's a concept of producers in JSR 299. Can you explain a little bit about what they are?
We've talked a little bit about beans, about types, how you make your class into a bean. But sometimes you want a bit more control over what the bean is, what the implementation of the bean is, how it's produced, essentially. How does this bean thing get created? If it's a class, basically instantiate a new instance of it and give you that back with all the wiring and everything done and the intercepts applied. But sometimes you want a bit more control, right? For example, say you've got a legacy library and you don't want to touch it in any way, but you want to expose a couple of its classes as beans, so that you can inject them. Well, producer method would be a great way to do that. You could do the instantiation of the object yourself using the new keyword and just return it. So that would be the first use case, which is legacy libraries. The second use case is if you want to vary the concrete type of the object to inject at runtime. My classic example here is that you might have a web service, and depending on the result of the lookup from the web service, you return one object or a different object. Maybe we're talking about addresses. We've got a UK address and a French address or something like that, and depending on where the person is located, you return a different object. So that could be a use of producer methods. The third thing you can do is perform some custom initialization with producer method. For example, if you've got maybe some legacy code and you can get the constructor called, but you've got another method you need to call, like initialize or something like this. You could then use a producer method to instantiate the object and then call a custom method on it and then return it. So really, to sum up, it's real reason is just to provide you with much more control over the instantiation of new beans.
Now, you have a whole lifecycle event model that you can hook into, right?
Absolutely. So, sometimes, obviously dependency injection gives you a lot of loose coupling anyway, but sometimes you want it even more loosely coupled. Events are a great way to do that. So really, all this pattern is the observable pattern, but implemented in a type-safe fashion. Rather than using strings to identify which event is which, we use annotations and types. The event model is very simple. You can register an observer with the container, and then you can tell the container to fire an event, and the container will simply notify all the observers for you. There are a number of more advanced concepts in there, for example, asynchronous events, where the event is processed in a different thread. Transactional events are really useful for a number of use cases, but the great one they're useful for is if you want to notify the user after a transaction success or something like that, you can just register an event to say fire this event after the transaction success and use that to push a success message out to the user. So that's really events, very simple, and particularly useful if you want to interact with a framework or some piece of code that someone else has written. For example, a framework can fire lots of different events, and you can register an observer and hook into the framework's behavior in that way.
One of the reasons people do development in something like a Spring is the dependency injection and the ability to kind of unwire and inject mocks of things for testing. How would you handle testing, either unit testing or integration testing, a WebBeans-based application?
Right, so there's a specific facility for unit testing. This is through this idea of deployment types. Whilst binding types are great for differentiating things to inject at runtime, sometimes you want to be able to differentiate between, you know, which bean to instantiate or which bean to inject at deployment time. And you know, a typical example of this is you want to mock out some of your components. And so what you would do is, if you're in a unit test environment, you would put the deployment type mock onto those beans, and then you would enable the deployment type mock in your beanstalkXML for your unit tests. And that would simply allow, or simply mean that rather than using your standard beans, it would use the mock beans and inject them there. I mean, if you're doing integration tests, you know, a bit different, because you probably don't want to mock out certain things. You actually want to run the app in a fuller environment. So I don't really think there's, you know, I mean, integration testing is something that's, you know, in my opinion, better done in a full environment. So this is not something really where WebBeans gets involved. But for the unit testing, yeah, you've got the ability to easily mock, very easily mock, and have those mocks automatically used.
Now, also, I know that one of the big things that Seam attempted and is doing is, you know, scoped and stateful objects instead of stateless. So, you know, the concept of basically almost like in a session, you know, stateful session bean concept, I've got, you know, either session-based state or I've got conversation-based state. And I was listening to a podcast from Gavin King back in 06 at the server-side symposium, and his statement was something along the lines of, once you start thinking about conversations, you can't think about anything else. And he said something along the lines of, it's an essential piece of understanding how a web application is going to work. Now, I understand that you could do, you know, custom scopes, application request, session, conversation scoping, even in WebBeans now and in JSR 299. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting, this whole stateless, stateful debate. I was listening to a Spring presentation actually the other day, and you know, Spring have always been quite heavily behind statelessness, and you know, but they said obviously, well, you obviously need to use statefulness in some cases. You need to store state. There's no way around storing state. You need to know who's logged in. You need to, you know, if you're working in a wizard style environment, then you need to know, you know, what's on the previous page, what's on the next page. So you do need state. I mean, there's no way around this. I think, yeah, conversations do change the way you think about writing web apps. I mean, I know that in my previous job, I spent a lot of time. I spent days and days coding the framework essentially to allow me to do things like wizards. And wizards were really useful. Wizard style things where you've got next, back, and that kind of thing. Really, really useful. But just horrendous, right? Because, you know, you have to somehow stash away all the data, and you know, you wanted to do things like have a cancel button that actually really cancelled. It didn't just leave random bits of data in the database, and you wanted to actually have the back button properly working and things like this. So yeah, I think that conversations are, you know, essential for that sort of user interface. And yeah, I think increasingly people are seeing the benefit of conversations. I mean, if you look at, you know, Seam has conversations now, there's an Apache project that provides conversations. Spring provides conversations for JSF. So yeah, I think conversations are now a pretty universally accepted concept. So yeah, I think, you know, what's in 299 is really an amalgam of all these experiences of conversations.
Right. And it looks like, at least from my understanding, the way, you know, you would do it in JSR 299 is basically inject a conversation, begin it when you think you need to start it, store things in that state, and then end it, and it'll just clear itself up, right? It looks like it's pretty straightforward.
Exactly. I mean, you know, a conversation is basically, it's something that's longer than a request, shorter than a session, and it's something that you demarcate the beginning and end of yourself. So it's like a custom data store that you control the length of, rather than, you know, in a session, the user is kind of, well, in a session, it starts when the user logs in and it ends when the user logs out. In the request, it starts when they send and ends when the response is sent back. A conversation is a bit more flexible because you can have as many as you like, sitting there waiting to run. You can only obviously have one that's actually active at any one time that the user's interacting with. And you control when it starts, you control when it ends. In 299, quite simple, as you say, you can mark that beans should be stored in the conversation scope. That means that whilst the conversation is running, those beans will always be returned when you inject or look up using, for example, something like expression language data from those beans. Those beans will always be there. You know, you'll get the same instance back throughout the conversation. And yeah, to start and end it, you simply inject the conversation controller bean, which is a spec provided bean, and you call .begin to start it and .end to end it. There's an idea that we have in Seam, and I think in other conversation solutions, where in fact this is really just more for making things simple for users, but there's actually a temporary or transient conversation associated with each request. And this just means that things like your conversation beans are there even when you're not in a long running conversation, you know, so you can still access them and use them. But that conversation just starts at the beginning of the request and ends at the end of the request. So it's just like a mini conversation for the request. And that, as I said, just means that your conversation beans are accessible. You don't suddenly get beans saying, oh, no, sorry, can't be found. And then that conversation is promoted to a long-running conversation when you call begin and demoted. That's what it does after demoted, when you call end back to a temporary conversation.
When I'm looking at it, and I'm looking at the developers that I work with and the industry that I'm involved in, JSF is definitely, if you're going down the Java EE stack, it's definitely a selected option. And I understand, you know, you're dealing with a component-based, stateful model with JSF, if I understand that correctly. But what do you do with the people that are still using action-based controller frameworks? Is there a place for WebBeans for those?
299 defines serverless injection, so you can inject your beans. You know, you could write your business logic in your business logic in using 299, and you can then just inject your 299 beans into your action, into your servlet of whatever type, and use them as you would from as you would anything. So, you know, I'm sure if you're writing a Struts app, then you would have your controllers and everything in one layer, and then your business logic in another, you know, to give it a nice split. So, you know, here, yes, you wouldn't really change the way you would write your view layer in any great fashion, but, you know, you could use 299 to write your business layer and then inject those into your servlets and use them. In terms of, you know, I mean, I always, so moving on more generally into other view layers, I always say that, you know, if you look at, I mean, yes, there are sort of the older action style frameworks, but, you know, if you look at sort of current frameworks, modern, you know, up and coming frameworks, you've got things like Wicket and JSF, which are server side rendering frameworks. And then you've got things like GWT and Flex, which are client side rendering frameworks. So, I mean, obviously, 299 supports JSF, as that's, you know, as you said, that's a part of the Java EE stack. Specs can only refer to other specs. They can't say that you depend on some other piece of technology that's outside the spec space, as it were. But, you know, so there's definitely interesting options to integrate with other Vue technologies like Wicket or Flex or GWT.
So are there proof of concepts or anything around WebBeans specifically and Flex or GWT?
At the moment, we don't have anything for Flex or GWT. There is some work that's already happened around Seam and GWT. There's a number of actually quite big initiatives around Seam and Flex, a couple of competing initiatives. And I would expect to see both of those migrated across to WebBeans as a sort of, you know, vendor specific add-on to the spec, you know, JBoss specific add-on to the spec that can run with any implementation of 299, you know, fairly shortly. I mean, I should think both of those will come across within, you know, by the time we release sort of Seam 3.0.1 or something like that. I'd hope to at least see, you know, proof of concept for both of those view layers integrating with WebBeans. We actually have support for Wicket with WebBeans, with the implementation, our implementation, that pretty much does as much as the JSF stuff does. You know, you've got conversation support, you've got, I don't know if you are familiar with Wicket, but with Wicket you essentially write an HTML, plain old HTML, and that's where you put your style and your layout, and then you write Java components, and then you tie them all together with IDs. So, you know, here you've got Java classes. So what we offer with Wicket is the ability to inject your beans into the Java classes using the standard annotations from 299, and the ability to use conversations as well there.
So now, in terms of productivity, developer productivity, last year at Emerging Technologies, one of our shows, Dan Allen gave us a demo of, you know, using the command line tools to build a Seam application. You know, obviously, you're going to be building the next version of Seam with WebBeans embedded. But if you're, you know, saying from your JBoss seat here, how would you stack up the way the tools are heading in terms of developer productivity? You mentioned there was a plugin, there's a command line generator and modification tools. What's that going to look like for a developer going forward? And is there a particular IDE that you would suggest in doing work with, specifically to be more productive in doing work with, you know, Seam and with WebBeans in the future?
Absolutely. So really we offer two avenues, really. Well, JBoss offers two avenues, let's say, for tooling. The first of all is, as you mentioned, our command line tooling. The command line tooling is pretty simple. It allows you to do things like generate a new project, which sets you up all the configuration files. I should mention in WebBeans, we've managed to dramatically reduce the number of configuration files you need, so the project you get is much simpler anyway. But you know, it sets you up with all your configuration files. It also has the ability to generate sort of CRUD views from a database, reverse engineer a database, generate CRUD views or create new ones, that kind of thing. Dan would be able to talk much more about this than me, as this is very much his field. But he has a project at the moment, which is called SeamGen Encore, to try and revamp a lot of SeamGen. SeamGen is currently based on an Ant script, which is great. You know, it's a great way to get started, great way to, you know, do things really quickly. But as the number of options that we want to offer in SeamGen grows, you know, we want to offer support for GlassFish, we want to offer support for Tomcat, as well as JBoss as your deployment environments. We want to offer support for Rich Faces, for Ice Faces, for Wicket, for, you know, all these different things. Basically, the Ant script complexity just grows as n to the power n or something. So it's horrible. And I've enforced a rule that basically says you can do no major upgrades to SeamGen until we resolve this problem, because, you know, we can't have for one target and two frameworks, the Ant script had got to about 3,000 lines. So, you know, we'd be approaching a sort of 20,000 line Ant script, and that's just not testable or maintainable.
Right.
So the idea of this project that Dan's working on is to transform the core of this to be much more sort of modular, much more object orientated, and much more, with a simple plugin system, so that we have the core, and then you can, you know, someone else can go away and actually write a plugin for using GlassFish or using Tomcat or using Wicket or whatever, that, you know, whatever combinations you want. And I think this will be really useful to users, because we get lots of users saying, how can I make SeamGen work in my build environment, in my company? Every company seems to have a different build environment. So, you know, people want a way to be able to generate their own projects using their own build environment. So I think that's will be a useful thing, not just from our perspective, but from the user's perspective. And also, you know, with a proper sort of declarative structure to this rather than a procedural structure, which is what Ant gives you. We can do things like share configuration files between, do more sharing of configuration files between different types of tools. So not only, you know, scripting command line tools, but also IDEs, and, you know, especially if we use the idea of a repository like Maven uses a repository to store these files. You know, we should be able to say, well, here's a set of files you need to deploy to GlassFish for Seam, you know, 7.9 or something like that. And then any IDE can come and pick them up and build a project with them. So that's the idea with the command line tooling going forward. IDE-wise, we have a big project at JBoss called JBoss Tools, which is an Eclipse-based tooling set of plugins. These really cover pretty much now, I think, most of the projects that JBoss has. So, you know, not only Seam and Rich Faces, but also things like Drools or JPPM or, you know, JBoss AS, that kind of thing. And, you know, of course, we're going to continue to develop these for WebBeans. And I've been having lots of conversations with those guys about, you know, what they can do around WebBeans and how they can, you know, how they can continue to support Seam and WebBeans and develop a productivity in that area. I mean, if you think about it briefly, because WebBeans has this type safe dependency injection with annotations, actually the compiler does a lot of your checking for you. There's not half so much need for an extra tool to do the checking for you and to do all the, you know, the click through links and everything that kind of comes with a compiler and an IDE out the box. But there's lots of rules that and really well-defined rules that the spec has, and so the IDE can validate these for you. I mean, the other thing that we've tried to do with 299 in general is to move as many of the rules as possible to deployment time, so that basically all errors are notified to the user at deployment time. So there's much stricter rules about how things can fit together, which is part of the reason there's no outjection. Because that's kind of a free-form way of putting things into context. But if you have a stricter way of putting things into context where things are more organized, not only does it help programmers because it gives them a better mental model of their program, but it also means we can report errors at deployment time. And consequently, we can report all these errors in an IDE as you code with, you know, with extras on top of the compiler.
So I guess that kind of steps us into, you know, where we are in terms of the life cycle of the JSR.
The current state is that there was a public review draft back in November. This then sort of got, I'm not sure what the right term is. It was sort of the review period was extended, I think, and a second public review draft was published, I think around February timeframe. So that you know, there's lots of time frames in the JCP where, you know, things have to be available for this amount of time before you can move to a vote and all this kind of stuff. So the PRD 2, the public review draft 2, is the current draft that's available publicly. Subsequent to that, the expert group has really been working on integrating this with Java EE, because this is obviously fairly fundamental to a lot of ideas in Java EE, so there's, and it crosses the boundaries of a lot of Java EE technologies like EJB and JMS and JSF, for example. So there's a lot of alignment to be done. I know, talking to Gavin, who's the spec lead, that, you know, he's been doing huge amounts of work recently, sort of working on all these alignment issues, trying to get everything aligned as other, you know, other people like Sun and IBM and Oracle are looking for. I don't actually know a date for a final draft at the moment. I think really, you know, I know that Sun are aiming to have a good picture of all the Java EE APIs and what will be in Java EE 6 for Java 1, which is the beginning of next month. So I think we can see, you know, expect to see a fairly complete picture of what 299 will look like and how it fits into Java EE for Java 1. So probably not a proposed final draft, but, you know, sort of something pretty much approaching a proposed final draft. And what I can say is that really, in terms of features, what's in the public review draft 2 is pretty much a complete set. There's no new features going in. What's going on is, you know, aligning these features so that maybe the XML syntax for them, you know, is can't be agreed on and it is removed, or you know, maybe that somebody feels that this annotation would be named better slightly differently because it aligns better with the EJB, or, you know, the EJB lifecycle needs some alignment with the WebBeans lifecycle. Those are the kind of issues that are being dealt with.
So first, I want to thank you for all the information you shared today. It was a good interview, very helpful. If we were to try to read more about what you're doing, I do know that you're on the In Relation To blog, which is in.relation2/bloggers/Pete. But where else might we find you?
Yeah, I mean, the blog is sort of my main form of communication with the community. The other place to look for resources on 299 is if you just go to seamframework.org. You can go to the download section. You can find our latest release of WebBeans, which is the preview release. The preview release is basically a feature complete release of WebBeans. You know, it's not a release candidate because you know, we haven't got a final spec yet, so we can't move to a release candidate. But otherwise, it's a fairly sort of complete picture of what it would look like. Included with that are two or three examples, simple examples you can, you know, use to play around with it. We're currently working on starting to port some of the bigger Seam examples over to use WebBeans and JSF2 and things like that. I know Dan has been working hard on the booking example, and so we should have something published fairly shortly around that, I hope. You know, the booking example running on all of this stuff. And again, that's on seamframework.org. If you go to the documentation section on Seam Framework, there's a sort of a reference manual for $2.99 and for WebBeans. That's about 100 pages or something like that. And that really does give a nice sort of step-by-step introduction to all the features of $2.99 and how you would use them.
Fantastic. All right, well, Pete, thank you very much. And I appreciate you coming on the TechCast to share your information with us today.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Thanks to Pete Muir from Red Hat, a division of JBoss, for Skyping with me about JSR 299 and WebBeans. Also, special thank you to Dan Allen for lining up the interview. You can find out more about Pete and the rest of the team by following them on the blog. His entries are located at in.relation.to/bloggers/Pete. You can find out more about WebBeans on the JBoss Seam website at seamframework.org. We have links to the reference book, the JSR itself, and other information on our show notes page at techcast.chariotsolutions.com. This is episode number 33. This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace.com, the easy-to-use web content hosting platform. For a free trial, visit www.squarespace.com, and if you like what you see, use the registration code TechCast for 10% off your monthly service fees. Our theme music is Free Theme Number 3 from podcastthemes.com. Libsyn provides our hosting and syndication. You can leave us feedback at techcastfeedback@chariotsolutions.com or leave a comment on the show notes page. To learn more about Chariot Solutions, including our education and consulting services, visit www.chariotsolutions.com. For the TechCast, I'm Ken Rimple.